Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning into Paranormal Talk Radio. This is not the X-Files. We are not scientists. We are not mathematicians. We are certainly not school teachers. We are no experts. We are paranormal investigators who have come together to give our audience insight and educational subjects about the paranormal field. Join us live every Friday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. Without further delay, here are your hosts, Matthew J. Haas, and his partner in crime, Tim Vickers.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another exciting episode of Paranormal Talk Radio. You just have to love that explosion. How many paranormal radio shows do you know, Tim, that has a huge explosion in their introduction?
Only one, man.
Welcome, my partner in crime, Tim Vickers. How are you?
Good, sir. How are you?
All right. I was sweating a little bit before the show, but we worked out the kinks, and you know, we're good to go. So I know we're going to have a great show tonight for our audience. I hope everybody's excited, because I know I am. Tim, I know you are. We're kind of fans of cryptozoology. I don't know how much you are, Tim, but I grew up on reading books about Bigfoot and cryptozoology and all the cryptids that are out there, like El Chupacabra, the Jersey Devil, the Loch Ness Monster. I'm a huge fan of the Loch Ness Monster, Lake Monsters. But our guest tonight is a widely recognized cryptozoologist who's been on many TV shows. He's been on many networks, such as the National Geographic Channel. He's been on Monster Quest. He's been on the show with William Shatner, Where You Know What. He's in the new show, Missing in Alaska. So our guest tonight is going to be Mr. Ken Gerhard, cryptozoologist, and I'm excited and honored to have him on our show. What do you think of all that stuff, Tim? As a kid, were you into like reading books on Bigfoot? And I know I was.
As a kid, I loved the Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm old enough, and I, to tell my age, that I grew up with In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. I loved that show. And anytime Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster came on, I was, you know, I wasn't going to miss that. Enjoyed it. Was always one of my, always on my bucket list, even as a kid, that I wanted to go, at least go look in the waters where Loch Ness was supposed to roam.
Yeah, there's quite a few alleged lake monsters all over the world. There's one, I forget the name of the country, but I know there's one in our neck of the woods, up north, actually, by the Finger Lakes, Lake Champlain.
Mm-hmm.
They call him Lake Champ.
Yeah.
I've actually been to that lake. I went camping at Crown Point with a friend of mine, and we had a weird experience up there that I couldn't explain, but I'm sure there was some kind of explanation that I just couldn't think of.
Alcohol.
what else goes with camping?
Maybe some s'mores, and that's it.
But, I don't know. I found Lake Champlain to be really intriguing. Just it has a really rich history with all the sunken ships in the lake, and I don't know. It's got really cool history there. Have you ever been there, Tim?
Up north?
Yeah.
No.
Lake Champlain is it's a great area. They also have Fort Frederick not too far from there, and it's a former military fort, and it's not like together, but it's like somewhat, you know, it's like broken up a little bit, but, you can, what's cool about Fort Frederick, you can actually walk on the grounds and going in and out of the whatever remains on the ground. And, you know, they don't complain about you going in the thing and stuff. It's cool.
Nice.
Yeah. They also have a really crazy bridge over there that goes into Canada, because we're real close to Canada out that way. And the bridge is like, I've been on steep bridges, but this bridge is so steep, you can't even see past it when you're starting to go up the bridge. Like, you won't see the other side unless you're actually going on the other side. That's how steep this bridge is. So
that would be hard in the wintertime.
Yeah.
Be easy to come down.
Oh, easy to come down, yeah. Not so much going up.
Not so much going up.
No. I don't know. So I guess our episode is going to be about cryptozoology, maybe some zoology, and being that our guest is Ken Gerhard, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about Bigfoot and whatever cryptids that are popular out there. What are your favorites, Tim, as far as cryptozoology?
Well, as far as the legends or myths go, obviously, you know, growing up with the Loch Ness Monster as a kid, Bigfoot, I try to tell people it's just my brother in the woods, but they don't listen.
No.
Outside of that, I just have to say either that or the Chupacabra. You know, that's always been good. I'm a fan of crypto because, you know, in my own weird way, I like to, you know, every now and then try to think of, I rate what do I think will be discovered or have some type of valid evidence first. And, aliens, that's a whole other show, but, you know, I always put that, and aliens, not like the green men, even though possibly, or green women, but just some type of, you know, another life form other than from Earth. You know, I think that's probably the most probable, reasonable, not saying it's going to happen in my lifetime, but of things that could be validated, I think that's right there. And then right under that, as I like crypto. And again, it doesn't have to be Bigfoot or Loch Ness, only because I think they might be small, but they're finding new species of animals a lot. And I don't think we've found everything on this planet, including whatever lurks under the water, which, you know, you will not catch me searching for animals down deep in the ocean.
You might find some megalodon.
I don't care, whatever, but I know as soon as I step foot into the ocean, I'm no longer on, you know, top of the food chain. So I like the beach, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that you'll find, you know, some type of what might be commonly referred to as a monster. But I think as far as finding new species, it happens regularly. So, you know, who knows what you'll find.
Yeah, I like what you said when you brought up, when you said, you know, a big percentage of the Earth is yet to be explored.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to say what kind of species are living in these areas that are unexplored? And just because, I mean, they label them as monsters, but, you know, just because we don't know what they are, so we just call them monsters, I think that's just the media kind of making them out to be like a scary thing because it's going to kind of make them money in a way, and, you know, it gives them something to write about or put on the news. You know, we had a sighting of this, and this person's afraid because, you know, they got scared and, you know, not sure what they ran into, but they, you know, it was a horrifying experience, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, I don't know. for me, though, yeah, I'm a big fan of Lake Monsters myself. Loch Ness Monster has been one of my favorites for a long time. I'd love to visit Lake Loch Ness and do my own investigation, go out on a boat, bring a video camera and just like sit out there, do some fishing while I'm there.
I'll just camp on shore. That's what I like.
Yeah. But I know it's funny how the Loch Ness, Lake Loch Ness, you know, their town has kind of built up a reputation for that, and it's helped their economy in a way because it's brought a lot of tourism in. I'm sure.
Oh, you better believe it.
Yeah, all people from all over the world, researchers, investigators, are there trying to spot this thing and, you know, capture it on film or photography. And, you know, same thing goes with Mothman, which is kind of in your neck of the woods, Tim, not far from you.
That's my brother, I'm telling you.
You know, that's another one that a town has kind of thrived off of the legend because they have a festival every year.
Yes.
And tourists come all over the world to, you know, check out this festival, and I'm sure it brings in a lot of money and revenue for them around that time of the year, and, you know, people are kind of banking off of it, and, hey, you know, I'm not against it. I'm just, you know, kind of saying, like, the popularity of certain cryptids of, you know, recent sightings of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So
have a movie made.
Yeah.
About the Mothman. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was actually, I like the movie a lot. I like Richard Gere.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was a well-done movie. Did you like it?
It was okay. I watched it just because it was West Virginia. I wanted to see that how accurate it was.
Yeah. Were they accurate?
Well, a little bit.
A little bit. Well, it's Hollywood.
It's Hollywood.
They kind of
film about West Virginia filmed in North Carolina. I'm shocked.
That's funny.
Yeah.
But what are you going to do?
So, well, I've got some questions for you.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready?
Okay.
So it's not necessarily paranormal news, but I've been scattering about for something to talk about a little bit.
Okay.
About the news, and I ran across a questionnaire about how would you know if your house is haunted.
Uh-huh.
Ah. You ready for it?
I'm ready for it.
So we'll go through step by step.
I'm going to fail.
No. Well, you know my thoughts on that. If you say yes to any of them, you've failed. Here we go. So, number one, and this is, I've gotten this, I don't want to not give proper citing. It's an older post. It's actually last year around Halloween, but the title kind of struck me. It's from the Huffington Post. So here we go. Here are some of the most common misconceptions and truths that this person has come across to discover if your house is haunted or not. So number one, you felt someone tap on your shoulder when no one was there. What do you think?
A nerve in my body, or I don't know. Do they have animals? You know, like a cat creep up behind them and poke them with their nose and didn't know it. Were springs popping out of the back of the couch, and you know they're time to get a new couch because the springs are popping out. I'm trying to think of all logical explanations, of course.
Yeah. It's something interesting. What this person considers, yes. You feel somebody tap on your shoulder, chances are your house is haunted, if no one's there.
But how could you explain that logically, though, like other than things that I brought up?
Well, there's this interesting phenomenon. I'm looking it up right now.
Okay.
I ran across it a couple of months ago, and if you've ever, do you carry your phone in your pocket?
No.
At any point?
Well, in the front pocket, I do it sometimes, because I don't like to be in a crowd because my phone clip is kind of bulky, and like I could clip it onto my belt or my waistline, and I'm afraid if I do that, you know, like in a big crowd, I don't want to like have somebody walk by me and swipe my phone from me. So I tend to, if I'm in a big crowded area, I put it on the inside of my pocket with the clip, out, you know, with the phone inside my front pocket. So not my back pocket.
Okay. So this is from an article. I think I found it. It's from Wired.com. But it's phantom cell phone vibrations. The reason I find this interesting is because this happens to me. You don't have your phone in your pocket or on your clip, but yet you still feel it. You still sometimes think you have a phone call. I found that interesting.
Like brain memory kind of thing?
Well, maybe. So if why I find that interesting is, one, because it happens to me, I don't want to say regularly, but it's not bizarre if I reach for my pocket because I think my phone's vibrating and I don't even have my phone. The reason I like that is because I don't know what's going on inside my brain. You know, why is my brain telling me I'm getting a phone call? So I'm feeling a phantom stimulus.
Kind of sounds funny.
Yeah, well, there you go. And it's free.
Well, some people in England would get off on that, but I won't say who.
So, when I know that my brain connected with my body can produce sensations of feelings and stimuli that aren't there, you know? So we know this happens. So that kind of takes me back to, what about the tap on the shoulder? How do you know you got a tap on the shoulder? You know, are we talking to you? I guess you would want to break it down to, is it a tap on the shoulder, like you think you got tapped, or is it the type of tap on your shoulder that jerks your coat off your sleeve, you know, off your shoulder?
Right, but then you got to get into like specific type of pressure when you're touched. Like what was the amount of pressure when you allegedly, you know, had this experience also? Like, was it a tap, or was it like some, did you feel somebody's actual hand kind of like, you know, grab you a little bit, you know?
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's interesting to me. Also, it makes me think about, what do you do for a living? Do you lift weights? Do you work out? Do you do a lot of heavy labor? Could you have sore arms? You know, what's your age? Have you ever had surgery? Have you ever had any trauma on that part of your body? I think that's interesting. And that type of stuff is not addressed here. It just says, if you feel that someone's tapped you on your shoulder when no one's there, then that is a sign of a haunting. I'm not buying that one. What do you think?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, you have to investigate it, you know, like I said. That's what we do. I'll interview a person to death to make sure that they're not experiencing something on a medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there could be something medical going on, and they don't realize it. That's why in my interviewing, I ask extensive medical questions. People look at me like I got five heads on my shoulder, like who am I to ask these people these medical questions? But, you know, if you have these medical conditions that we should be aware of, then it may not be something paranormal at all, because what if it's something medical and you need to go see a doctor for that?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I agree. So I think that's just interesting right there to me. Okay. So number two, because we'll kind of speed along. So
am I passing so far?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we're thinking very critically. I think so. The whole getting tapped on your shoulder thing, it really doesn't impress me at all. I just, you know, true to form, you know, you look at it as, I felt something on my shoulder. I felt a tap on my shoulder. No one's there. Therefore, it must be a ghost. See, I don't agree with that. I mean, there's a lot of things just you and I in the matter of just a couple of minutes have thought out that should be looked at.
Yeah.
Before you consider paranormal. So number two, your furniture is constantly rearranging itself.
Hmm.
So this person, although I find that more interesting than a tap.
Yeah.
This person says no.
I had an interesting, not to interrupt you, Tim.
No, yeah.
To add to this, I actually had, we investigated Francis Tavern in New York City by the South Ferry. And great place to investigate. They had a lot of history with the Sons of Liberty. George Washington had meetings there. And they actually had a piece of his coffin on display in one of their cases in the museum. And one of the claims of my client was that every morning they would find it in a different position. And you know, I'm thinking to myself, vibration right off the bat, because, first of all, this is like a busy area, a busy road, and any vibration over time is going to move anything in that display case, because it's not, it wasn't really the best display case in the world.
Right.
You know, and the floor is very old, so anything that's going to vibrate will vibrate very easily, you know? So mm-hmm. I think of along the lines of that, does the house, is it located near a train station, a busy road? What kind of traffic is passing by? You know, things like that. Are there potential minor earthquakes in the area that could, you know, possibly vibrate furniture to move up?
That's a good one, especially with all the fracking debating going on now.
Yeah. Those are things I think of with that.
Yeah, I do too. And again, it's very vague, so it doesn't say what type or how, you know, what are we talking about furniture, you know? So, you know, honestly, I'm going to be worried. If I come home and my couch is stacked on top of my living room table, which has two or three chairs on it, you know, I'm going to want to know what I found out. It's probably still just someone coming, one of my friends coming in.
I'm going to add something more interesting to that, though, Tim. Now, what if a person claims that they actually saw the furniture move with their own eyes?
Mm-hmm.
And they were aware of the surroundings and what was going on at the time. They were well aware of everything. And they still saw a piece of furniture move by itself.
Well, I don't think that discredits anything that you just said.
Right.
Like, you can't see a vibration unless it's massive. Unless, you know, you might see an effect of a vibration. You might see a wall, you know, shake back and forth, you know, according to the waves. But I don't think that would discredit anything that you thought about. Vibrations from anything coming through the house. Now, if I saw my couch lift up off the ground and land on my kitchen table.
It's aliens.
That's a demon alien.
They're affecting your couch.
I swear I saw an orb underneath of it. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Number three.
All right. We have, just to keep track of time, we have 7 minutes before we call our guest tonight. So.
All right. We'll hurry up.
Yeah. Okay. We can always finish this after our guest, too.
Okay. People have died in your house. Would that make it haunted?
Not necessarily, because, you know, it's funny. One thing I always say is, if it was a place I hated, why would I want to come back to it?
Well, I don't think that either. I'm not sure exactly how or why that's a continuation. You know, we kind of spoke about that, I think, last week. Why is that a continuation of a presumption of a haunting because someone died there?
Yeah.
From other than, you know, people really thinking that it would be because, you know, that's the way folklore always goes. So if you die at some place, I mean, if you think about the millions of people that have died prior to us, billions, you know, there should be haunted places everywhere.
Yeah.
There are ghosts everywhere. Personally, I have, you know, I live in a house that the prior owner died in the bedroom. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting on my computer just feet away where he was found dead. And nothing, ever. We've never even thought about it, you know?
Did you get a good discount on the house?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a very, for lack of a better word, I don't know what you want to say, but a positive death. You know, he lived in this house all his life. He passed away of, complications with old age. This is where he wanted to die. This is expressly where he said he wanted to pass away at, and he did. He died in his sleep in his bed. So it was very good, very peaceful.
Yeah.
So well, never a problem.
Better than gruesome death, you know?
Yeah, which is another. You know, how come that, oh, man, he got killed by a hay baler?
Yeah.
You know that field's haunted. Why? You know, why? Why does that automatically always come back to, you know, a painful or untimely death? You know, have allegedly a higher probability of a haunting. You know, who wrote that book? Who made that rule? You know, everybody seems to know that rule, but who did it? Under what circumstances did someone say, we've done scientific testing and research, and
yeah,
our conclusions are, you know, and then if you think about it, you could even label the probability of hauntings by how violent the deaths are.
Yeah, definitely. I want to just kind of get into the bio a little bit here about Ken before we just dial him in real quick. But yeah, Tim and I will get further into that toward later in the show. I think it's a really cool discussion. I'm glad you brought it up this week, because it's really, I think it's a good survey. So, Ken Gerhardt is our guest tonight. He's a widely recognized cryptozoologist. He's got a new show on the History Channel called Missing in Alaska, and he's a field investigator that basically explores the Alaska Triangle. There are a number of alleged Bermuda-type triangles all over the world, and one of them happens to be over Alaska. And in this remote area of Alaska, they go and investigate all these weird phenomena. And I think it's a pretty cool show. They use special equipment. They fly over in helicopters to kind of go over the land. And, you know, sometimes there are missing people involved. There's missing airplanes, missing craft, and all that stuff. And I think it's fascinating the type of research they do. He also has a book out called Encounters with Flying Humanoids, which I'm probably going to buy myself because it's probably got a lot of discussion about the Mothman, man-birds, gargoyles, and other winged beasts. And again, he's been on other networks such as Monster Quest, which I was a big fan of. I love Monster Quest. I love their research and their investigation. He's also been on the show Weird or What with William Shatner, and I'm jealous that he actually had a great chance of working with William Shatner, which was probably a great experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I actually tried to get him as a guest on our show once, but
William Shatner?
Yeah. I was like, why not? I give it a shot in the dark, but his PR person got back to me and said, unfortunately, he had a decline, and there was no reason, but I was happy to get that far.
Hey, you got to know. That was awesome.
Yeah. The fact that I talked to this PR person was awesome. So I'm going to go ahead and call Ken in, and so bear with me here, and we'll have our discussion with Ken in a second. Here we go. Is dialing? Dial tone is good.
Yes.
Yep.
Hello.
Hey, Ken. It's Matt from Paranormal Talk Radio and Tim Vickers. How you doing?
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm doing great. How are you doing tonight?
It's finally great to have you on a live episode because we had you on way back when Paranormal Talk Radio first got on Blog Talk Radio, or even before that, we had you on as a guest. We did a pre-recorded interview with you, and it's really fantastic to finally get you on our live show, and we're both honored to have you as our guest tonight, so, you know, thanks for taking the time to be on our show.
Well, thanks. It's an honor to be here. And isn't it this your 50th episode this evening?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah. Tim, yeah, this is our 50th, and Ken Gerhard makes our 50th episode tonight on Blog Talk Radio.
I didn't realize it was our 50th.
Neither did I. We just keep banging them out, so, you know, we just kind of go with it. And so here we are with our 50th. That's great. I'm glad, Ken, you could be a part of that, and it's special to us. And we're a big fan of yours. I know I am. Great new show, Missing in Alaska. Congratulations on being in the new show. And you've had fascinating work with other shows. I'm jealous that you had a chance to work with William Shatner. You know, but we've talked a little bit about that before. What do you think?
Hold on a second, Matt. I have to interject something. Unfortunately, I never actually met William Shatner. Now, I was on a show that he hosted. That's true. But, and of course, that was my greatest hope, is I would have an opportunity to meet him. But the episode that I was on was about the Mothman, and I was up in Point Pleasant doing an investigation. Well, apparently, Mr. Shatner, for that particular show at least, was not contracted to leave his house. So all of his scenes are filmed in his backyard, in his garden, in his driveway, and in his living room. So it is his show, and he hosts it. But apparently, to get him to leave his house was very expensive. So the show was only able to afford him at his house. So obviously, he was at his house in California, and I was in West Virginia. So I never actually got to meet him, unfortunately.
Ah, okay. That's good. Thanks for the clarification. that's still pretty funny, though, that, you know, that you have to pay him a lot of money to do that. But
I wish I could get paid to work in my backyard.
It's William Shatner.
Right. Oh, that's a joke.
Literally, he's talking about the Loch Ness Monster, and he like, starts standing out by a swimming pool, and then when he's talking about being out in the wilderness, you can tell he's walking through his backyard, through the garden. So it was pretty funny, actually. I thought he's a funny guy.
Yeah, he is. I think he's great. Like I was telling Tim before we just dialed you in, I tried to actually get him a guest on our show. I don't know if he does radio or whatnot, but I figured why not, because he was doing Weird and Wild at the time, and I figured it was a shot in the dark. But you know, it never hurts to try. And I was just happy I got as far as the PR person. For those who are unfamiliar with your work, if you want to briefly tell our audience a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in cryptozoology, and we'll go from there, and I'll start with a line of questions after that.
All right, definitely. Well, for those of your listeners that are not familiar, there might be a few, I am a cryptozoologist. Cryptozoology is the field that investigates evidence of unverified species. And, you know, a lot of people kind of view as what we do is very romantic, and sometimes it can be, because we investigate many legendary beasts like Bigfoot and the Yeti, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, the Jersey Devil, Mothman, you know, a lot of those kind of mythological monster-type creatures. Cryptozoology can also encompass more mundane things like discovering a new species of lizard or rediscovering an animal that was presumed to be extinct and so forth. But I feel very fortunate to do what I do, and it was not something that I necessarily planned to do as a career, but you know, basically it's just been a lifelong passion and interest of mine. And as I got older, I had an opportunity to travel around the world with my family and go to some pretty amazing places, and began investigating at a young age. By age 15, I was at Loch Ness in Scotland doing field work. And through the years, I've worked with a lot of my heroes in the field of cryptozoology, and been involved in a lot of investigations. And as you mentioned, I've written some books and done some television shows now, so...
yeah, you definitely got some great background, and I respect you a lot, Ken, because you are humble about your work, and you are very passionate about what you do, and you know, I give you it's commendable, you know, for somebody to do it with a lot of passion, with, you know, how you do it, and you know, that's what I love about your work and what you do. So that's one of the great reasons why I, you know, like having you on our show. And your background, you do like all kinds of things, like you said, anywhere from Bigfoot to Jersey Devil, El Chupacabra. In your opinion, Ken, what have been the most fascinating investigations so far for you in your career so far?
Wow, that's a tough one. Well, first off, thanks for your very fine, kind words are much appreciated. I do try to remind myself that humility is important no matter, you know, what your endeavor is in life. And going back to something you said that I think is kind of important about passion and patience, those are two words that go back to the founder of cryptozoology, Bernard Hovelmans. He always kind of emphasized that. You have to have passion, but obviously the field of cryptozoology requires a great deal of patience because you're seeking out and investigating mysteries, enduring mysteries that have gone on for decades or longer. And, you know, I also try to be very objective, too, because this is a scientific pursuit, quasi-scientific pursuit. And, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in the subject matter emotionally and to become emotionally attached to it, almost like a belief system. You want to believe that these things exist so bad. But you have to look at it in terms of objectivity and evidence. So as far as investigations, man, I've been very lucky. I've been on a lot of very fascinating investigations. Of course, I've had some very recently up here in Alaska. I've had a good time looking into some pretty iconic mysteries up there. You know, I love the jungle. I've done some investigations down in Central America, the nation of Belize, that were pretty amazing. As far as the overall in the field of cryptozoology, I guess the chance that I was able to go to France back in 2009 and investigate the Beast of Gévaudan, which is like a alleged to be kind of a werewolf type creature that killed possibly as many as 100 people, and it's still one of the greatest mysteries in France as far as what this creature was and what actually transpired back in the 1760s. So I was part of a History Channel special called The Real Wolfman, and they flew me over to France to conduct an investigation, and that was pretty memorable because I had access to a lot of old documents and archives and access to different places that most people wouldn't be granted access to. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I enjoy that myself when I have to go through archives and when we get audio evidence through what we do as paranormal investigators, we get or collect EVP evidence, and sometimes we're trying to get we try to connect information with history, and we try to make connections
sure.
there. And sometimes I'm in a basement, and it's in a way overwhelming when you see like stacks of records or file cabinets, and it's like where do you begin? What's your process when you start your investigations?
Well, you know, each investigation is different. Some are spawned by eyewitness testimony. You know, people, of course, contact me all the time that have had remarkable sightings of things that they can't explain. If they're very credible and the interview process goes well, sometimes I'll arrange to go out and do an investigation there. You know, other times we're focused on a particular area. So if there's like an iconic area that has a history of activity, kind of a hot spot, maybe I'll team up with other investigators that have a common interest, and we'll just kind of go over a plan, you know, look at the logistics of, you know, how long do we need to be in that area? What do we need to look for? You know, it's just... The thing about it is, and one of the reasons I love doing what I do, is that, you know, each investigation is literally so very different. I mean, you're talking about different types of habitat, investigating a lake monster versus going into the mountains to look for evidence of Sasquatch, or you're down in the American Southwest desert looking for the evidence of chupacabras, or, you know, whatever. So I can't say that there's like a set game plan each time, but I will say that it's a process where you're always learning, and I don't think there's any endeavor in life where you basically have figured it all out. So you're always constantly learning and sort of restructuring your game plan and, you know, just based on your experiences.
Yeah, you're always on your toes.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of surveillance that goes on. You know, obviously, there's two basically general approaches to doing cryptozoological research. You can go into an area where there's been sightings or activity, and you can look for physical evidence, things that are going to jump out at you, like tracks, droppings and scat, nest habitations, hairs, things like that. Or you can do a surveillance type situation where you're basically camped out in an area for a period of time and you're using photographic equipment or thermal imaging equipment or sonar equipment or whatever the case may require to try to, you know, basically survey the area and see if you can find evidence that way. So it's always different.
Yeah. What do you enjoy about those parts the most? Like, which are particular enjoyment in a specific area? Like, do you enjoy the technical side of things? Do you enjoy more of the interviewing? What's your most favorite part of that?
That's a good question. I think the best part about being a cryptozoologist is that on your very worst day in the field, you're basically on a nice camping trip. So you're in the outdoors somewhere enjoying the beauty and majesty of the outdoors. I think the thing that really gets me excited, well, a couple things. One is interviewing eyewitnesses and meeting people that have had remarkable experiences and just kind of looking into their eyes and trying to look into their soul and provide some form of closure, some answers for them. But also meeting other experts is a real thrill for me. And when I have an opportunity to travel around to areas and do investigations in locations that I'm not familiar with, you know, I'll usually track down the local expert, whoever that may be, the person that has the most information, and, you know, just talking to people that have accumulated knowledge in any specific field or area is always exciting because you always have an opportunity to learn things yourself. And I'm very blessed to have a network where I have correspondences with many brilliant people all over the world with a wealth of knowledge and expertise in different areas. So I always like to pick their brains. It's always fun.
Sure, sure. One of the things, I happen to be, well, Tim and I happen to be very fortunate to interview Dr. Hawaz, the famous archaeologist who made many discoveries.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's on every show about Egypt. If you watch, he's on pretty much everyone. Yep.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
It was great. What have been some of the people that you've ran into that you admire the most, that you respect and kind of maybe that inspires you, and what experts have you enjoyed working with?
Well, for example, in the Beast of Jebunan case that I told you about, I met with a gentleman named Patrick Souye, who actually runs a museum in the Gévaudan region of France, the Auvergne region now, and he has, you know, basically this huge collection of all the original documents and archives and just a wealth of knowledge. While in Paris, I was also able to meet up with Jean-Jacques Barois, who is a famous French cryptozoologist. He passed away just a couple of years ago, but he had done a lot of amazing research through the years. There's so many. For this recent Missing in Alaska episode, I had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Robert Alley, who's the Alaska's leading expert in Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and I mean, he's just a brilliant guy. Many around the world. I mean, in England, I have colleagues, John Downs, Richard Freeman, Dr. Carl Schuker, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, John Kirk. I mean, there's just so many people that I look up to that just have so much just expansive knowledge in the respective fields.
Right. That's cool. You know, definitely admirable for that, to work with so many greats in the field. You know, not many people can say they work with, you know, such people.
Yeah. I'm sorry to cut her. I want to point out that, unfortunately, because I kind of got involved, I mean, I've been doing cryptozoology for a long time, but didn't get to the to the status or the point where I could meet with some of the founding fathers. And the field of cryptozoology was founded in the 1950s by a French zoologist named Bernard Hovelmans. There was also a Scottish zoologist named Ivan T. Sanderson, who was a very well-known Fortean. Dr. Roy Mackel passed away recently. So, you know, and some of the giants of the Bigfoot field, like Dr. Grover Krantz and Rene DeHinden. So one of my greatest regrets is the fact that I never had an opportunity to meet with some of the people that I'd read about growing up that really started the field of cryptozoology, and, you know, many of them passed away before I had an opportunity to meet with them.
Right. What did you think of, Ken, at the time that it happened on the news? I remember a few years ago, they had these guys who claimed to have Bigfoot, you know, piled in a big thing of ice. That, you know, they claimed to have his body, and it turned out to be a big hoax. And I remember that. I don't remember exactly what area of the region that was, but I was so disappointed in to see, you know, like the transformation of that. And as a cryptozoologist, we can relate to things like that because, you know, people fake paranormal stuff all the time, and it gets on our nerves.
Sure.
You know, me and Tim are passionate about what we do, and we want to find concrete evidence, and, you know, we're out there to try to, you know, get research and evidence. And what are things like that, when you run into something like that on the news, how does that make you feel?
Well, I typically ignore it, you know, because I know it's a bunch of crap. And there are a lot of people that are going to, like you said, hoaxing has been a part of cryptozoology, paranormal, UFOs for as long as all of those fields have been around. As far as cryptozoology goes, I mean, you can go back to the 1800s. The great showman P.T. Barnum actually had a quote-unquote mermaid that he is putting on display and charging people to see, and it was basically the upper half of a monkey sewn to the bottom of a fish. It was called the Fiji mermaid. There was a scientist who had taken all of these prehistoric whale bones and built a sea serpent skeleton that he was charging people to see. And so, you know, it's been throughout history, there have been many examples of people trying to hoax and fake evidence. It does give a black eye to the field in some respects, mainly because the people that hoax typically get a lot of publicity. And when they do get publicity, then people that are watching at home that are indifferent, that really don't have a lot of knowledge about what's going on, say, oh, see, it's all fake. I told you Bigfoot was fake. This guy's faked Bigfoot, and, you know, that proves that it's all, you know, BS. But they don't understand that the other side, that there's a you know, a lot of circumstantial evidence, eyewitness sightings and different things, photographs and things that are going around that they've never been exposed to. They're only exposed to the hoaxes. And I think that's a really frustrating thing because it makes all of our jobs much harder.
Yeah, definitely. And I like the word you brought up. It's frustrating, extremely frustrating, even for us. So,
yeah,
but you brought up Missing in Alaska. I did watch, I was able to watch an episode or two. It's a really interesting show. I like that, you know, it's different and basically investigating the phenomena of the alleged triangle in Alaska. What's your focus with the investigations as far as the show goes, and what are your goals, and what are you hoping that, you know, what are your findings, and what are you hoping to kind of achieve?
Well, thanks for bringing it up. You know, it's kind of it's almost like a two-pronged investigation show because, as you mentioned, there are an alarming number of disappearances that take place in Alaska, and particularly in this area known as the Alaska Triangle. Now, at the beginning of the show, they say thousands of people have disappeared or been reported missing. That's true, but what they didn't, the follow-up that they don't state at the beginning of the show is that a lot of those people were found eventually. So, but still in all, Alaska has the highest percentage of missing people in the U.S. by far. Now, a lot of that you could explain rationally and say that it's a very treacherous place. You have freezing temperatures. You have aggressive wildlife and just vast areas where people can get lost and so forth. But on the other hand, there's also a lot of unexplained phenomenon in Alaska. Everything from mysterious creatures to UFOs to hauntings and different things like that. So we do investigate the missing people cases in conjunction with some of these other mysteries. Now, what makes it personal is that one of my cast members on the show, Tommy Joseph, who's a native Alaskan, he's a Tlingit gentleman who does carving for a living, totem poles and things. His father is actually a missing person. So his father disappeared
really?
When he was very young. So yeah, he has kind of a personal stake in terms of figuring out why people do vanish. The other two cast members are myself and a gentleman named Jack Atwell Menez, who's a private investigator. So between the three of us, we bring a lot to the table. The first three episodes, as you mentioned, two involved kind of UFO activity, the vortex theory, and the third one was about the Alaskan Bigfoot or Hairy Man. We have 10 episodes that have yet to air, and most of those episodes have to do with kind of legendary creatures, of all different shapes and sizes. We also have kind of an episode about spirit form activity as well, and one about conspiracies and things. So, a pretty wide range of topics, but it all goes back to the kind of the root idea, which is that, people are disappearing in Alaska, perhaps for, objective reasons or pragmatic reasons, but perhaps some of those disappearances can also be linked to unexplained phenomena, who's to say?
Yeah. Alaska is kind of a hot spot. I always said I would enjoy like an Alaskan cruise and be on a cruise and go to Alaska on a cruise ship, but I'm kind of afraid now because like with all the shows that are out there, I always used to say I would love to go out and find gold, like the show Gold Rush, and mm-hmm. but with my luck, I'd be going out there, I'd be one of those missing people that you see.
Some people going actually went missing while we were filming. Some people went missing. There was a gentleman that while we were in Juneau, there was a gentleman who went up to a very popular tourist spot called Mount Roberts. You can take a kind of a sky car kind of up to the top of this mountain, and he went up there and disappeared while we were up there filming. So there was also a guy that fell off of a cruise ship. You mentioned cruise ships, and when we were out in a boat filming, we got a warning from the Coast Guard to be on the lookout for this guy that had fallen out of a cruise ship. So it's a pretty treacherous place. People do vanish.
He thought he was DiCaprio, and he thought he was on top of the world, and instead he was on the bottom of the world. But I like the show. Like I said, I find it really great, interesting, and what I find really fascinating about what you guys stated in the show is there are actually not just in Alaska, but all over the world, there are these unusual spots all across the world of other triangles,
yep.
other than the Bermuda Triangle, and like you said, one of the theories and idea, is the vortex theory. Do you think that, is it possible for all these to be, connected to one? Maybe they're all connected somehow?
Well, certainly it's possible. And so I have to qualify, of course, first by saying that, as a cryptozoologist, I'm obviously specialized in certain areas. I've always had an interest in UFOs and the paranormal and stuff my whole life, too. But the vortex theory is pretty—it's pretty far out there. It's obviously dealing with quantum physics, more specifically something called hyperdimensional physics. And so, a vortex—and you mentioned the Bermuda Triangle—is a theoretical disturbance in the space-time continuum that could represent a window into another dimension or reality that's beyond our, nature of reality, our perception. So basically, there's different ways of looking at that. One is being that, Einstein's theory of string theory, which, states that there's basically more than three-dimensional. So consider that, for example, that the three-dimensional universe that we're able to perceive is merely an illusion created by limitations in our neural hardware, or that, there are other dimensions of time and space and matter that are basically occurring around us at any given time. And we're just able not not to perceive them. So if that's the case, then theoretically there could also be windows, portals, tears, you know, doorways. People call them different things, but essentially events where there are connecting phases between these other dimensions, and that perhaps physical matter can disappear into these other dimensions, you know. So that was kind of our impetus for to do the show. And there's also been a connection with some of these vortex areas and UFO activity. So, you know, you could if you wanted, it's all speculation, of course, but you could take it to the next level and say that, well, if our planet is being visited by extraterrestrial or ultra-terrestrial beings, could they not also have the technology to somehow manipulate these other dimensions of time and space? And that's how they're able to travel here from wherever they're from. And perhaps that, you know, they are able to basically appear and disappear, you know, and basically as their will dictates. So for that particular episode, we investigated the famous case of a missing military plane. It was a Douglas C-54 aircraft that disappeared in 1950. There were 46 crew members aboard, and to this day, no one has ever found any trace of the airplane or anything. So it's a pretty heavy mystery.
Yeah, and the fact that there are no skeletons or anything like that either, and with the technology that we have available for us, that can, you know, scan the ground with thermal imaging and it really, you know, like, how come nobody's found bodies and stuff when these disappearances occur? You know, I find that really, really interesting. Like I said, it's really a big mystery.
It is, and it's, you know, it's pretty hard for us to wrap our heads around some of these theories, because we are, admittedly we are very limited, right, as far as what we can see, what we can hear. I mean, we have actually very limited perception in terms of our senses. You know, the other thing that we brought up in the show is our geomagnetic anomalies, and, you know, obviously, you know, the Earth's magnetic field. You have, of course, the hard iron ore core of the Earth, which has an amazing amount of geomagnetic pull, which we call gravity. And then you have the outer layers of the atmosphere, the ionosphere and so forth, which are being magnetically charged by the sun's rays. So, you know, you have all of these magnetic, you know, basically our whole world consists of all of these geomagnetic fields. And, you know, magnetic energy is very powerful. It courses through and runs through all living things. It runs through our whole planet. So that's another, you know, potential possibility in terms of these vortexes, is that they could be somehow connected to or linked to these geomagnetic fields, and thus could there, you know, and thus could be manipulated again by, you know, higher civilizations.
Yeah, definitely. My partner Tim, he's very much into the whole quantum physics and all that stuff, and Einstein, and like Tim's a lot smarter than I am as when it comes to that part of research. But Tim, I know you're into that. So what do you think of you know, the show and the ideas of the vortex and all that stuff? I know you're fascinated with that end of things. So what do you think about the vortex being a potential idea?
I've tried. I've dipped my hand into quantum physics through the University of Maryland. And let me tell you what I learned. It is hard. It is incredibly hard. I can't even begin to tell you. I don't understand it. You have to speak math to understand it. So I think all that, as long as people are pushing the envelopes and thinking different ways and looking at different ways to try to solve problems, that's great. But when that stuff's out there, you need a quantum physicist on site, probably two or three of them.
Exactly. And thanks, that's Tim. I'm definitely not one, so I struggled with that particular episode with a lot of the theoretical stuff that we talked about. But, you know, I guess it just comes back to that. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I think we're lagging just a little bit. I'm just, I'm not a quantum physicist. I didn't go through a course. It was very interesting to me. I tried it out. I did an introductory course with it, and it kicked my butt. I mean, it tore me down really quick. So I'm not either. I love it. I love the thought of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the bottom line of it is, and you know, again, people much smarter than us, much smarter than us, probably understand this, but there's so much about the workings of our planet and our universe that are just beyond our comprehension at this point, that we just can't understand. And we're making strides a little bit each year, aren't we, in terms of scientific endeavors, but it's just hard for us to wrap our heads around some of these concepts, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I have a question, Matt's been doing a great job. I've loved every question and love listening to you guys talk. But I have a different type of question.
Sure.
Which it keeps running across my mind. Have you had several? And if you've had several, what's your most intense one? But have you ever been in the field investigating or looking for any signs or evidence and really had this, you know, an uh-oh moment, that whether it was either something you were looking for or, another animal native to wherever you were that could have killed you? Have you ever had a moment where you thought, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Yeah, I guess that has happened a few times. People always, of course, ask me if I've ever seen any of the cryptids that I investigate. I never have seen one with my own eyes, so I'm always going to be a little skeptical until I have that visual verification. But in 2003, I believe that I heard Bigfoot vocalizations. This was in an area of North Texas. I was working with some other investigators, and we were at an area where there'd been a lot of sightings, a pretty remote area, actually, and as we were hiking around the lake one evening, we suddenly heard these very deep, guttural kind of grunting sounds. It sounded like some kind of ape or primate, very loud, very deep. We definitely couldn't connect it with any known wildlife in North America. So it reminded me of primates that I've heard in Central America, things like howler monkeys and stuff. So we didn't get a visual sighting of the thing. We could hear it moving around. We could hear these vocalizations. We recorded them. It was pretty nerve-wracking there for a few minutes because we could tell this thing was big and very close by. We couldn't really see it because it was in some heavy brush. And we did find some corroborating evidence the next day when it was daylight. We found some tracks. We found some mutilated turtle carcasses, their shells that had been ripped apart. So I'm fairly convinced that and I was unarmed that night, which, you know, is not always the norm for me here in Texas. A lot of times when I go out in the wilderness, particularly at night, I am armed with a shotgun or something because you have snakes and wild hogs and mountain lions and all kinds of things that can be kind of dangerous. So that was kind of a pretty anxious evening in terms of what we heard and knowing that this thing was close by. And so that, I believe that's the closest I've ever been to a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch. I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I can't tell you definitively that's what it was. But I'm fairly convinced that's what I heard. And that was probably the most remarkable thing I've ever experienced. In terms of other investigations, I don't always like to talk about this too much because I think people become more skeptical when you say you've had more experiences, but I've been on it's just a numbers game. The more investigations you go on, you are going to experience things ultimately, you know, if you stick with it. So I was investigating Bigfoot in the state of Ohio one time, and I believe I saw a UFO flying overhead. It was a big black triangle-shaped object that was completely silent, and it had flashing lights. I couldn't equate it to any airplane or helicopter or anything, and so that was kind of weird, being on a Bigfoot investigation and seeing a UFO. And, it could have been a military craft. I mean, who knows? All I know is I'd never seen anything like that before. And then finally, I'll say I've been on some paranormal investigations where one in particular where I saw a heavy door slam all by itself. and went shot, and I spent some time with another investigator trying to debunk it and figure out if there could have been a breeze or if it had been rigged somehow, and we never were able to figure out why this heavy door slammed. And then the last one is kind of a subjective thing. I was investigating a haunted, the South Pittsburgh hospital there in southern Tennessee, and I was walking down a hallway one night by myself, and I felt this feeling that people have described as basically like electricity coursing through your body, like I was being electrocuted. And, you know, it wasn't painful. It was just very unnerving. I was kind of disoriented, and I definitely felt something. It was a very subjective thing, but it was like a tingling all over my body. And it was almost like I was being probed or something. So those are the things that I've experienced in my years of research. I've never seen a Bigfoot with my own eyes or any other cryptid. I've never seen an apparition or an entity, but investigated or interviewed many people who have claimed to have seen those. So I'm hoping I get to see something.
Out of all the cryptids that are out there, which is so many, and there are so many ongoing investigations, there are so many legends, and obviously so much out there to really choose from, but. Ken, in your line of work, up to this day, what would be one cryptid that you would love to have an encounter with out of all of them? Is there a particular favorite that you would love to have an encounter with?
Well, I guess all of them. I know that's kind of a lame answer, but I think my main focus of my research over the years, even though I've got a pretty diverse portfolio, has been the flying cryptids. And you mentioned my recent book, Encounters with Flying Humanoids. I don't know if I'd want to run into any of those, the Mothman or anything like that, because they are often linked to calamity and tragedy and things like that. But as far as the Thunderbirds, and if you're not familiar with Thunderbirds, they are these gigantic birds that people have reported. They look like eagles or buzzards. They go back to the accounts go back to Native American folklore, but I've investigated dozens or maybe even hundreds now of modern sightings of these giant birds with a 15 or 20 foot wingspan. I think it would be pretty remarkable to see one of these things. They must be pretty amazing in terms of the size and scale that people report. And they don't seem to be very aggressive towards people. At least I haven't had a lot of accounts of aggression, so I don't think I'd be in really any danger seeing one of these things. So, but you name it, man. I would love to see a sea serpent or Bigfoot or a lake monster, anything like that. I think would be a pretty validating experience.
Cool. When you talk about the dangers, like you had briefly mentioned in your thing there. Out of some of the investigations, what were your, I'm trying to word this in a way, have you ever felt at risk that you were in danger, or have you felt like I shouldn't be there, or have you ever felt like your life was at risk maybe during any of your investigations?
Not to blow my horn here, but I mean, I think one of the reasons I do what I do is I'm really not afraid of a lot of things in terms of anything in nature or anything unexplained. What scares me is people. So that's where the danger lies. Whenever you run into, whenever you're in a very remote area and you run into people and there's not really a strong, sense of law and order, that kind of thing. But couple of times when I believed that I heard Bigfoot vocalizations, I actually moved. And other times when I was with people and claimed that they saw Bigfoot, I always moved toward the alleged object. So I don't really get spooked. I love being in the woods at night. I have a sense of calm and peace out there. I respect nature, and I worry about animals that can be threatening to humans, but on the other hand, I really feel that humans are the most scary animals on the planet, and I try to take that attitude or that approach when I'm out in the woods. Like, I'm the badass out there, nothing's going to mess with me. So, no, I haven't really felt in peril at any particular time, other than the time that I told you about when I heard those vocalizations, my hair was standing up on the back of my neck, but I didn't feel a sense of impending doom or anything like that. I was just freaked out.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We always say that on our paranormal investigations, and my wife mostly says that, you know, more afraid of the living than we are of the dead. You know,
yeah,
like one time, yeah, we were investigating a plantation down south in Maryland, and we were on Chesapeake Bay, but we were kind of in the middle of nowhere. Like, the amount of acres on this property, like, the nearest neighbor was probably, like, 45 minutes away. And my wife was like, it got turned into a bed and breakfast, and the caretaker was, you know, setting us up for the rooms for the night, and, you know, she's like, all right, you're all set. And my wife's like, where's the keys? And so the innkeeper's like, oh, we don't have keys here. And we're looking at one another like, you know, like, we're from New York. Can we fix the place up? You know, like, we're looking at one another like, because we're more afraid of the living than we are the dead, you know?
Yeah.
So,
that, yeah.
But I can totally agree with that comment. But we're winding down with our interview. If there's info, any events you'd like to share, where can they look you up? I know you have a website. I'm going to put it in the chat room. I'm going to share it on our Facebook page as well, so people can get pointed to your website. But if you want to share any of that stuff, go right ahead.
No, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks again for having me on. It was an honor to be here and be part of your 50th episode. Congratulations once again. Yeah, I do have a website, KenGerhard.com. I also have a Facebook fan page if people want to go on there. Either place you can get in touch with me, you can find out more about my research, look at photographs, and read my bios and different things. I will be appearing at the Mothman Festival this year for the very first time. So that takes place.
Oh, I wish I could go.
Yep. September 19th in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where it all went down in the 60s. So I'll be giving a lecture along with some other impressive speakers, and I'll be selling copies of my Flying Humanoids book, autographed and so forth. And I'm also going to be appearing at the original Texas Bigfoot Conference. If you have any listeners in Texas who are interested in Bigfoot, The Unexplained, that takes place October 9th, I believe. It's October 9th and 10th in Jefferson, Texas, and that's going to be a pretty big event, too. And then my new show, Missing in Alaska, it's currently on hiatus from the History Channel, but it should be resurfacing either on History or History 2, hopefully, in the coming weeks.
Awesome. And I wish you, you know, so much luck in your endeavors there. It's a great show. I recommend it to our listeners if they're into this stuff. You know, check it out. I enjoy it, and I know if you're a fan of cryptozoology, you'll love it. And you know, the triangle stuff is really fascinating. But, Ken, thanks for being part of our 50th episode. It was a special meaning to us. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm a big fan of your work, and I hope we can keep in touch, and maybe when I buy your book, you can autograph it for me someday.
Absolutely. I would be honored. Well, thanks again for having me on, guys, and thanks to everyone who listened in. This was good. A good time. We'll do it again real soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. We'll keep in touch and, you know, definitely stay in touch and, you know, take care of yourself. And I'll be watching you on TV.
All right, guys. Appreciate it. You have a good
All
night.
Right, take care. You too.
All right, bye-bye.
Have a good weekend. Thank you.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
All right, everybody. That was Ken Gerhard, a widely recognized cryptozoologist on the new show, Missing in Alaska. You can catch it on the History Channel. And like you said, hopefully on the History 2 channel. You know, he's been on Monster Quest, National Geographic channel. You can catch him on a lot of things. And great guy, a lot of knowledge in that area. And I don't know, for his sake, I hope he runs into a cryptid. So, Tim, what do you think? Great interview.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. I do find cryptoids very interesting.
I don't know if I want to run into a Bigfoot, though.
No. I don't either.
Yeah. and I don't know if I want to run into an El Chupacabra. I'll leave that to Ken.
So, yeah, I'm not experienced for that.
No, that's his job. So we'll leave that up to him. Again, you guys can reach his website at kengerhard.com. Pretty self-explanatory there. And get his book. I know I'm definitely going to get it because I want to read what he's got in there about flying humanoids. It's called Encounters with Flying Humanoids. And I will post it in the on our Facebook page. And I guess we can continue where we left off with our survey. Tim, if you still want to go ahead with that.
Where
did we leave off?
To tell, number four.
Okay.
All right, here we go. So number four of the reasons you could relatively say your house is haunted is because you hear strange sounds more commonly during certain seasons.
Wait, say that again.
You hear strange sounds more commonly during certain seasons.
Hmm.
No, yeah. We don't even really have to go into that one.
That's a stretch.
Yeah. Okay, here's one that I find interesting because I hear this a lot. You probably hear this a lot too. Number five, you suddenly smell the perfume of a loved one.
Particularly, you know, what I find pretty funny is a lot of places we investigate. Out here we have what we call the Long Island Gold Coast era, and a lot of the mansions use like air fresheners, or even like some museums that we investigate use those automatic air fresheners. And there are even like oil scents that people use today like crazy. I don't know what they call, but and then you have scented candles. So, I mean, those are things that I think of.
We worked a place that was reporting smells. It's a very old house. And the smell was of cooking. It was baking cakes, pastries. And even though it was a house, apparently this, you know, the house a long time ago was used for baking pastries. So if I'm not mistaken, if I don't get this, you know, I'm to the best of my memory without looking at any notes. So the owner, the husband, had a job, but the wife supplemented, and we're talking 1920s or 30s, the wife supplemented the income by baking goods and selling them. So after she passed away, it changed hands a couple times through family, and current day, the people that we talk to would say that often they are awakened at night by the incredible, overwhelming smell of baking in the kitchen to only find out there's no one there. I found that very interesting. One of the things that I did, and I have to admit, I didn't get the answer. I didn't get an answer that was really satisfying to me. But I began looking at how long can a scent molecule exist. Do you know what I mean? If you live in a wooden structure, wooden kitchen. If you can only imagine the amount of scent molecules, odors, and I'm sure they smell great, you know, that would be in that kitchen constantly. I also looked at the dates and the times that they would record smelling these things. You know, was it at night? Was it, you know, what time of the year was it? What were the weather patterns? Because, interestingly enough, just like number four, I wondered if there could be anything due to the stress of the house under environmental conditions that might stretch or compress or bend a piece of wood or some parts of woods that could not reanimate, but maybe emit some old scents. If there's any scent trapped in that wood. But before I could really go that route, I had to find out if the scent molecule could actually get trapped in a piece of wood. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it can. I mean, I hear people say a lot that that houses, you know, retain different smells for very long periods of time. But I wanted to know, you know, I wanted to be sure, and I had a difficult time finding if that was true. But that was where my guess was going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, why not? If it's like an oil, and, you know, oil is hard to get out of stuff, you know, mm-hmm. hard to clean. You know, some scents, depending what it's made out of, you know, if it gets embedded over the years, you know, depending, like you said, how old the place is, I don't see that far-fetched.
I kind of would imagine old perfume would, or perfume in general, would have been oil-based.
Yes.
I could be wrong. All right.
So.
That one's out the window.
Literally.
And number six and the last one. You've had a frightening experience in the attic, basement, or crawl space of your house.
Well, generally, they're creepy.
Yes, yeah, we're already going on the same.
Like, I would throw basements in that, too. You know, when you go into a basement, basements are generally dark and moldy and full of spider webs and dust webs and dust and...
And every horror movie you've ever seen that someone dies in the basement runs cleanly through your mind. Every death scene, you're like, oh, yeah, now I remember.
It's like, why are you going down into the basement?
Oh, I hate steps going down into the basement that don't have runners behind them, that they're open from behind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because then, like, you can expect hands to grab your ankles.
Yeah, straight from behind. And they could be right under the steps. You never see them, and they just reach out. Hate that.
You know
if
what?
I would ever buy a house that had those, I would fix it immediately.
You know what movie scared the hell out of me when I was a child? Right? My mother one time had on Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about these things that lived under the stairs.
Oh, yeah.
I must have been like, I don't know, between 8 and 10 years old. And for an 8-year-old, you know, that's scary stuff. And after watching that movie, I was like afraid of things under the stairs.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's what makes me think of that. But psychologically, can play a big effect on a person. Fear factor is what I think of.
That's it, isn't it? I mean, I think that's the biggest piece of the pie for that puzzle. You know, psychologically, you set yourself up for fear. And then when you're down in the basement, every little creak and every little pop of the wood becomes a beast of the evening.
You know, it's funny because sometimes me and my wife, we're always afraid of things following us because, you know, like I said to our listeners a while back, we did have an attachment that was negative experience, but maybe sometimes sitting on the couch in a quiet setting, and once in a while we'll hear a creak, you know, tick, pop. And it's funny because now that we use a lot more critical thinking in our investigative techniques, that when we hear a big pop, we're like, fridge, electrical box, compressor outside. You know, we're always like tagging it. So it's kind of funny, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's why I brought that up. I was just, you know, reiterating the, you know, the fear factor. And then when you hear something, it's not always paranormal, but, you know, figure out where it's actually coming from.
Yeah.
So I like the survey. It was pretty fun.
It was fun. I think I'll try to find another one. You know, and I think pretty obviously that was for fun. You know, it was an article written close to Halloween of last year. So I'm sure it was put out for entertainment.
But
however, you know, I kind of think maybe, you know, more than some of them, we've both heard allegations, you know, surrounding haunted houses using them.
Yeah.
The smell, I hear that a lot. You know, I can smell, you know, old pipe smell and pipe tobacco. You know, I hear that a lot. And the cooking smell, I've heard that before. Perfume, I've heard a couple times. You know, but is that just a function of the environment? Is that, you know, just something physically retained and not in a, you know, strange metaphysical way, but something literally, is it something retained that releases? I don't know. My bet would be yes.
Yep. I know. I think, though, the person that wrote the article should have had a disclaimer, and because now every amateur investigator is going to say, oh, then that this place is haunted because somebody got tapped on the shoulder. So it should just say, you know, this is strictly a survey, blah, 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 and that's all it is, you know.
Well, I'll be real quick because I know we're running out of time, but I read, so I'm a little bit in between questioning there when I was looking at the article. I had it pulled up on the phantom vibration syndrome. What they got around to understanding is, especially in pockets or if you keep them in belt clips in your shirt pocket, you become very alert to your phone ringing because it's usually important. You know, it's from home, from your work, from your kids. So you train yourself, whether you know it or not, you train yourself to be aware of that part of your leg. So whatever part of your leg in your pocket that your phone's leaning against when it's in your pocket, you have a little bit more hyper awareness of that area. So what their explanation was after you've trained your body to pay more attention to this area because it's important if you get a call, when you don't have your phone in your pocket, some type of stimulation, even if your pants, say you sit down and your pants rub or stimulate the area that the phone would typically be, your brain remembers that stimulation as a phone vibrating. So it's not the stimulation that's being sent to your brain. It's the memory of your brain interpreting that stimuli as being your phone's ringing. So that's why it feels like your phone vibrates in your pocket. And that kind of stuff just messes with my mind.
Yeah.
And so, you know, something so simple as your brain tricking you into thinking that your phone's ringing in your pocket, and you feel it. You know, something that simple, when something that simple can be identified, because imagine the other possibilities, you know? Like, what else do you misinterpret? What else do we misinterpret naturally in our environment that we label as paranormal?
Yeah, and I know. Good survey. It was fun. I think we should do more.
We should.
Yeah, I was going to add more to that, but I had a brain fart again. We're getting down to the end. It's like I always like to do, Tim, is make our announcements for our upcoming schedule.
Do it.
Yep. It's that time again. I want to, you know, we're heavily supporting this big event that's taking place October. Saturday, October 17th in Geneseo, New York. It's called the C2D1 Haunting 30th Anniversary Paranormal Symposium, which I am very honored to have been selected to lecture and speak on this event. What is the C2D1 haunting, many might ask, but those who are unaware of Christopher DeShazeri, he went to college and had a very physical physical haunting done to him. And there's a little description here about the haunting at the college. I'll read a little bit about it. Back in the winter of 1985, a dozen college students living in Erie Hall were terrorized by an extreme haunting. Lasting for several months, students eventually knew to stay away from room C2D1, where a full-bodied apparition was sighted and photographed. Strange disembodied voices were heard that were eventually recorded and moving objects witnessed. What makes this extreme haunting particularly compelling and unique is not just the duration, it lasted for several months, but its extreme intensity. The large number of credible witnesses, including a priest, a college professor, and several parents, the vicious physical attacks, and the amount of surviving historical evidence, hence the title of Christopher DeShazeri's book, Surviving Evidence. So I'm very proud to speak on the behalf of this event. Tim, I hope you're going.
It's a little far away for me.
Yeah.
But I know you will represent well.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm excited. There's going to be a bunch of people speaking. Please check out the website, C2D1Haunting.com, and there's also going to be a ghost hunt investigation in with this event at the Hanging Tree, I believe it's called. If I have it wrong, forgive me. Looking it up right now. It's called the Torture Tree, and I will help lead the investigation along with John Tobin, Mark Avila, and others. Can't wait. Like I said, I'm excited. The reason I bring up this event again, next week, Tim, we have two very special guests. We're actually reuniting Mr. John Tobin and Chip Reichenthal will be our guests August 28th, next Friday. Real excited because these two individuals are a really big part of my inspiration, especially Chip. He's been a mentor of mine in the radio industry. And, you know, also a good colleague and friend. And I've gotten to know John over time as well, and we've become good friends. John Tobin is a big part of Glory Haunt Hounds. The group is still around. They do a lot of events all throughout the tri-state area. And, you know, John is a very passionate person, not just investigating, but historically. You know, he's very much into history. And I appreciate that about him. Chip Reichenthal has a book out called Even the Dead Won't Tell You the Truth. It's fiction, which is unusual for a paranormal investigator. And, you know, he also has his own show called Understanding the Fringe on darkmatterradio.net. They both together had a show called Keeping the Spirits Alive. And that's pretty much, Tim, what inspired the two of us to connect and start Paranormal Talk Radio. So having them two reunited on our show as guests, I think, is really cool.
Yes, I enjoy talking to both of them each time. Really good.
Yeah. So, can't wait. That's August 28th, next Friday, and I don't know, it's coming up. So, put it in your calendar, and we'll, that's it.
We'll see how that unfolds.
Yeah, we'll see how that unfolds. But I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. I hope everybody enjoyed our episode and our guest, Ken Gerhard, widely recognized cryptozoologist. He was a lot of fun. I really respect him because he does what he does due to passion for what he does. You know, he's great to watch on TV. You can see it. And, you know, he's not, you know, he doesn't have a big ego on his head like many people on TV. And he's approachable. You know, you can talk to him, and I've talked to him from time to time, and he's a great guy. So I really appreciate that about him. You know, check out his website, kengerhard.com. And I want to thank him publicly again for being our guest.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. Tim, anything else to add before I play our exit song?
Have a great and safe weekend.
Yes. And no trespassing.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't want to see any more investigators on the news. All right. See you guys next time.
Thank you for tuning into Paranormal Talk Radio. We broadcast live every Friday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. Don't be intimidated by the hosts. We would love to get your feedback about our show, whether it is good or bad. You can leave comments on our Blog Talk webpage or email us privately at paranormaltalkradio@gmail.com. Would you like to interact with other listeners or the host during the show? Register free with Blog Talk Radio to chat with us live during the show. You can also look us up on Facebook, answer questions and polls, and get the latest news. Until next time, see you on the other side.